Hey, this is Talking with Paul Wilde on 3rd March 78 at Radio Physics in Sydney. So the first publication that you have is Wilde and MacCready in 1950, but I know that you were working on these data before then. Can you tell me how you came to radio physics and so forth?
Sure. Well, I was during the war, after 1943, I was doing a very rapid 2-year type degree at Cambridge. I went straight into the Navy for the rest of the war and a bit more.
Is that in physics?
That was, you mean Cambridge?
Yes.
Was maths part one and physics part two. I would have been a mathematician had it not been for the war.
I see.
The war took me to... I was appointed after a 6-month crash training course in radar. I joined the battleship King George V, and that's how I got to Sydney for the first time. And Sydney was our base for a number of operations in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, among other things, I got engaged to be married to a Sydney girl. And then I returned to England in the ship and had to continue serving in the Navy on an instructional job until February 47 when I came back to Sydney. In the meantime, I had lined myself up a job with CSIRO, the London office.
Did they advertise in England? For...
I just went along to the Australia House as well, yeah, and asked if there were any research jobs.
I see.
And the first job I applied for, I didn't get, and a chap by the name of John Bolton got that job. He was also in the Navy.
I see.
But he was demobbed in Australia, and not in... He had a slight edge on me. He was on the spot. And it turned out that our careers had been very similar, we both, except that he'd been 1 year ahead of me, both at Cambridge and both at Navy, both applied for the same job. I think both became chief research scientists almost together.
Hmm.
And one stage we were both joint vice captains of the radio physics cricket teams. Very similar.
Dick McGee has produced a photograph of your old cricket team,
right,
which I find delightful.
Yes.
Let me ask you, while I think of it, you were in the Navy as a radar officer. I'm fascinated with the parallels between the Seacliff interferometer and what was known from radar practice during the war. And the basic question is, was it a very straightforward thing to... having worked with radar in the war, someone like Quasi, to say, let's put it on the Seacliff? Or was it a very clever thing to do?
I think the principles were really straightforward. I suppose the credit goes for going out and doing it and making it work.
Right.
Nearly everything is simple after the event.
Right, but the whole business of effects of refraction and the Lloyd's mirror effect, all this was well known from radar practice.
The first decent piece of work I've seen on the refraction effects was the work done by, I think, Trevor Piercy as a sort of footnote to the Pawsey's, Ron McCready, Pawsey, Payne Scott.
I see.
Royal Society of Paper. And that's that was an original calculation by Trevor Piercy, I think. Trevor Piercy was a sort of mathematician,
mm-hmm,
in this division. And that was quite an important contribution. But certainly, I mean, aboard ship we used to do height finding by this technique. Used to have a large Perspex board with with all the lobes drawn out, and you saw where the first detection was and where the first fade was, and that gave a high.
Right.
And
did you worry about refraction at all, or did you not need that much accuracy?
Well, I think it was strangely up to the individual. In my case, I didn't. I had charge of the whole height finding operation, and I calibrated the thing entirely empirically by aircraft runs. I didn't use.
With friendly aircraft, you mean you had have them go at a certain height?
Scarpa flow. And they would come in and do run after run after run.
I see.
So, then check for the theory afterwards, and my memory was a very good fit. But
what sort of frequencies were these radars?
Well, this one was 45 megahertz. The two, 45 and 80 were the two long range warning, both very low frequency.
And what sort of elevation would you be able to first pick up a plane?
If it was at sea level, you would hardly pick it up at all. Unless you pick it up on one of the centimeter on one of the microwaves. If it were 10,000 feet, I suppose you'd pick it up at 50 miles. If it were 30,000 feet, you'd pick it up at 120 miles.
So 10,000 feet is 2 miles. At 30 miles, you said, there's one about 3 degrees elevation, something like that.
Yes. The 30,000 feet is a fairly accurate one, I think, but the other one is rather taxing my memory.
Okay, so I was just wondering about that.
The job I actually got was as a research officer, as it was called, was to work in the test room. It's really doing research associated with test equipment. And
now, who was it that assigned you to that? Was it
Pawsey? But I was working immediately under Fred Lahaney at the time, in your meet, you see. And I spent a year or so, that would have been February 47 to February 48, about then, in the test room, where I was like a fish out of water completely. I wasn't particularly interested in the work. And I was very anxious to get into research, especially what was known as solar noise research. Radio astronomy hadn't been invented as a word then.
Right.
And the small group was known as the solar noise group, even though some of it was doing non-solar work.
And you undoubtedly were hearing about their exciting
results. Oh, yes. And I was very glad when Joe Pawsey almost said, well, you're not doing much good there, we better try you on research. And that was the start. And I had the choice of doing... I was given the choice of getting involved in two things. One was to go and join John Bolton, who was going very well at Dover Heights. And the other one was to... it was suggested that the next step...
We haven't finished?
Yes, I'm finished.
Okay, sure. It'd be cold and horrible.
You're being recorded.
That's okay. Second choice
suggestion really it was at that time was to look into the feasibility of building a solar spectrograph, since they'd been taking recordings on different frequencies and were finding some very interesting time relationships. And
so So it was Pawsey's initial suggestion.
Right. And it was something that Lindsay McCready had on his books, as it were, to do. But he had various other administrative things. And, so I came in as the junior boy, as it were. And I decided that that would be a better thing, because I'd have much more independence on that. And I knew John as a man of considerable personality, and he'd already established himself. So Lindsay was a very good person to work with, in that he gave a few initial suggestions. He was quite a receiver wizard during the war on radar. Very modest sort of a person. He sort of more or less drew the first circuit diagram, which was a great help to me. But it was a long way to go, and then he left me very much to my own to develop it. And,
let me just ask about McCready, since of course I can't talk to him. Was his role in the various projects that he was involved in mainly to build receivers?
During the war, very much so. The slab was, as you gathered, was entirely a radar establishment during the war.
Right, but in the radio astronomy projects after the war?
Radio astronomy? In the early days, he helped Joe Pawsey getting the equipment together, getting the receivers together. It was very often very much taking an old wartime piece of equipment and adapting it.
Right.
And he did that very much himself. But when he came to this project, he was so preoccupied with so many things that it was in the end left to me. And I had one assistant, Bill Rowe.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Rowe and I sort of put the thing together. John Murray joined us later.
Right.
And it was really, we set up at this sort of shack at Penrith Railway Station, and we used to go up by train every day. And towards the end, it was, I think it says in there, the total observing period was 4 months.
Right. In 1949.
That's right, it was produced as 4 months. And towards the end of that time, John Murray joined us, and towards, it was at that time we discussed, things looked pretty good. There was a need for a properly engineered thing.
And the first was properly engineered.
String and seating wax, absolutely. Thrown together. I'm not an engineer in any sense, but John Murray is a meticulous engineer, and he, on a considerable time scale, I should say, put together the receivers on the next phase, which was the Dapto equipment.
But just going back to McCready, what I was getting at was, was he involved in the interpretation of the data at all?
Not at all.
Projects? Yeah.
Not at all. Obviously, he showed great interest in it, but he wasn't.
Right. Okay. So now going back to...
He was very much an engineer, I guess that was where he... And, he never got really involved in what we would now call the astrophysical side of things.
Going back to building this first spectrograph, what were the problems that you had in building it, and how did you solve them?
Well, the point was, at that time, to my knowledge, nobody had built a swept frequency receiver which had a good noise figure. and it was a question of getting a good noise figure over something approaching a 2-to-1 frequency band. And anything you did at one frequency tended to upset something on another frequency.
Right.
So it was a matter of, and of course one had to use, in those days, rotating condensers, capacitors.
Mechanical tuning.
Mechanical tuning. And the problems I remember most were, first of all, getting enough power out of the local oscillator over the frequency range. I remember we used an extraordinary tube called a doorknob tube, which I think has long gone out of existence, but it was sort of shaped like that. It's a great pity that somehow that equipment got thrown away somewhere. It would have been quite a museum piece because it would have looked quite extraordinary. On the other, the task was getting rid of all the parasitic oscillations which seemed to want to creep into the system. Yes, the time scale really, prison standards was fairly short. We threw that together. The aerial was a huge wooden cross with pivoted at the bottom with wires to make it into a rhombic.
Was that pretty obvious that to use a rhombic aerial, you needed a wide band?
Well, that was really. That was Joe Pause's suggestion. He was a real expert on aerials. He was overseas while it was being built, and he was rather distressed when he came back and saw it. He had ideas of building it out of bamboo. He used to love bamboo because it was so light and so on, and he was rather horrified to see this very heavy thing which was dragged around by ropes. But I think we'd probably. The main thing was that it worked. We got the answer.
But about how long would you say it was? 6 months to put it together?
Well, I think it was probably began around about March 48. And I'm not sure when the observations
were sometime early in 49 they began.
Probably about March 49. But of course one had to spend some time looking for a site which was reasonably free from interference and accessible and so on. So it probably took about.
Well, John Murray's told me about searching for the Dapto site, which of course is much further away from metropolitan Sydney.
Yes.
How were you able to get by at Penrith, which isn't that far away, I guess?
Well, we learned a lot from the Penrith observations. What we used all the time as a monitor was an experimental FM station in North Sydney, 92 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And we went around really with a truck monitoring the station's signal strength. And it was about, well, there are many taxis and this, that, and the other, various others, but it was the dominating signal. About this site at Penrith, it was relatively low compared with Sydney District. But then when we chose a new site, we were still really plagued by this one signal. It was, and it was almost an obsession to get away from it. And that's how we went much further afield.
I see. It wasn't a matter of.
And the Dapto site was a very, very good one because it was screened by these tall hills.
It wasn't a matter of the entire band filling up in the 3 or 4 years.
No, not really, no. It was
lots of signals came in, aircraft, taxis, mobiles, and so on. But we always used this 92 megahertz as the, it was by far the strongest, and it was the criterion.
So you got this thing built, and what happened when you put it on the air?
The Penrith one I'm talking about.
Yes, right. Yes,
Penrith. Yes. I should say, in the early days, we had a movie camera, but we didn't actually have a motor, so we turned it by hand. And we changed the aerial every 20 minutes. We changed its position by ropes, adjusting the ropes. And Bill Rowe and I used to take 20 minutes watches. And when anything came, you know, just looking at the screen, mm-hmm. waiting for something to happen. And of course, we didn't know quite what to expect. We knew what these looked like on a single frequency rate. But the first few occasions were this tremendous excitement, seeing the holes as a sort of scan rise, and eventually rightly identified what was undoubtedly a type 3 burst, one that went across the scan.
Mm-hmm.
And one that moved from high to low frequency. It was quite dramatic. Sometimes a whole week would go by with absolutely nothing. Perhaps more than a week. And that was an awful lot of work, travelling backwards and forwards and watching for nothing to happen. It seemed so at the time.
Sure.
And then on other occasions, it was huge, tremendous activity.
Were you monitoring the sun optically at all at this time?
We had I can't remember whether we had I think we probably did have a small telescope to look at sunspots.
You had one at Dapto.
Certainly at Dapto.
Right.
Yes.
But I'm not sure.
But I'm not sure myself whether we...
You don't remember?
No, but there was a great deal of monitoring done in the lab, and we did keep... it was known, you know, that were... not that we came to the lab very much at all, but we were in telephone touch. So we knew when the sun was spotty or active.
Which you would go out even if it weren't spotty?
Yes, right, because it's just as important perhaps to find out what happens in the
right.
dark period.
You had no idea at first.
Right. And when eventually we got, I know John Murray told you this, but when we got to Dapto, we had a dreadful first 3 or 4 months. It was right in the middle of the sunspot. Nothing happened at all.
Well, yeah, and he also said you wouldn't observe at all if there were no spots. You just gave up.
Well, it was...
maybe not in those first few months, but...
Well, it was automatic recording then. It was on the intensity modulated film, so there was no effort involved. You didn't sit down in front of the thing waiting, as it were.
Right, but...
You could go and...
But didn't he tell me that if the sun were not spotty, that you didn't even bother going out to the site? I thought I remembered him saying that. Maybe I got it wrong.
No, I think we used to keep up a regular, usually 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
If there's anything on the weekends, we used to do it. But that was fairly regular, but we closed everything down, solar observations down for a period when we got a bit fed up with the low level of activity at that time, and we started scintillation radio style.
Right.
But,
well, going back to Penrith, yeah. A question came to mind. You said that there were swept frequency receivers, but that they were not a good noise figure. But these were not. These were not being used in radio astronomy, though. These were for some radar application or something.
Sorry, which of these?
Were there any being used in radio astronomy by your group or anyone?
You mean swept frequency?
Right.
No, I think ours was the only.
Right. So these were used in radar or something.
Not set frequencies, I know. Now, as far as I know, there were no split frequency receivers which had very good noise factors around at that time. Most spectrum analyzers had of that era were, I don't think you'd even measure a noise figure. They weren't for that sort of sensitivity at all.
So you apparently took a few months of data and began to see some patterns in what you were saying. Can you sort of describe to me what
yes. came out of this? At the end of that observing period, I suppose we collected so much film that it seemed to be a sensible thing just to stop and try and make sense of it. And I spent weeks and weeks in the dark room. Plotting everything out. I think I could even show you the original plots.
Yes, I like these large color diagrams which you made by hand. How did you go from the small 16 millimeter film, or is it 8 millimeter?
I think it might have been 35 millimeter.
35 millimeter.
Well, 35 millimeter was an A scan. It is intensity, vertically, and frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something like that. And then one had to calibrate this for receiver sensitivity. And this was done by injecting noise at different levels. And it was by no means anything like that, but it was a very curvy thing.
What sort of accuracy do you think you had in the intensities, or at least the relative intensities?
Oh, the relative accuracies, I suppose, are pretty good. I suppose it was a few tenths of a decibel or something. And I had to make corrections for the aerial, the variation of effective area across the...
As the spectrum. Sun went through the beam?
No, I mean... The beam followed the sun. I mean, 20 minutes.
Well, with 20 enough. Minute increments.
Oh, no, that was enough.
So you didn't need to worry about that. Okay.
Didn't have to worry about
that. But you mean the frequency response?
But the frequency response, yeah. You had to make adjustments, right, sort of thing.
So were these large sequences made up then of every second or something like that?
That's right, yes. These are the time in seconds and to a second, I think.
Jeez.
And it was a matter of scribbling down in a notebook all these sets of numbers where it crossed the different levels and then plotting it out. But obviously when you have something like this, which is a very dramatic and beautiful thing, the incentive was considerable to go doggedly ahead and do it. And this was another example. This is known as, this is a type 2 burst.
Type 2 is a slow drift.
And type 3 is a fast drift. That is probably the cleanest example that came out of it. These were due to some instrumental imperfections, mismatches, yes, that's right.
Were there quite clear demarcations between what you call type 1, 2, and 3? Was it pretty obvious that those
there's a factor of 100 difference between type 2 and type 3 in the drift rate.
And very little that occurred in between.
Nothing in between, no, it was absolutely discrete. And
what about the type 1?
Type 1 was an entirely different phenomenon. That was sort of like little things popping up all over the place, like a choppy sea. That was entirely different. Then there were all sorts of rather nondescript things which we did describe. And that sort of thing that doesn't seem to have any character at all. In actual fact, it's probably a collection of type 3-like bursts.
Happening
you see very, yes, and overlapping and so on, but that's, you know,
so, yeah.
Unclassified. You see, very often we used to miss the beginning.